Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Challenge yourself as a leader and transform your career with a top-ranked MBA from Berkeley Haas. Gain access to a world-class university located in the epicenter of innovation and engage with renowned faculty, mentors, and collaborative peers. The evening and weekend MBA program delivers a robust MBA experience on your schedule. Excel in your current role while building leadership skills for what comes next. Visit haas.org/apply to start your Berkeley Haas application today.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Barlow, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 1st of January, these are our main stories. President Biden and Pope Francis have led tributes to Pope Benedict XVI, who's died aged 95. Members of the public will be able to view the late pontiff's body at the Vatican from Monday to pay their respects. And President Zelensky has said Ukraine won't forgive Russia for another wave of missile attacks on New Year's Eve. Also in this podcast...
3, 2, 1, go!
We hear about the marathon New Year's resolution that's taken a whole year to complete. President Biden is among world leaders who have paid tribute to Pope Benedict XVI, who has died at the age of 95. The US leader, himself a Catholic, hailed the former pontiff's devotion to the Church. For the first time in modern history, a sitting pope will preside over his predecessor's funeral. Francis, in his first public comment since the death was announced, described the former pontiff as a noble, kind man who was a gift to the Church. He was speaking during the homily at a New Year's Eve service in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome.
And speaking of kindness at this moment, my thought goes spontaneously to dear Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, who left us this morning. We are moved as we recall him as such a noble person, so kind. And we feel such gratitude in our hearts. Gratitude to God for having given him to the Church and to the world. Gratitude to him for all the good he accomplished, and above all, for his witness of faith and prayer.
The emeritus Pope Benedict became the first pontiff to resign since the Middle Ages, but lived within the Vatican and still wore white. Our religion editor, Aline McBall, looks back at his life.
Cerebral by character, Benedict was a prolific author and more at home with scholarship than pastoral work. He led the world's Catholics for 8 years and then abruptly resigned, the first pope to do so in 600 years.
Ut incapacitate meam administrare mihi commissum bene administrandum.
Joseph Ratzinger was born in southern Germany. He was just 6 when the Nazis swept into power. His parents were hostile to the regime, and though their son entered junior seminary in 1939, he was forced to join the Hitler Youth just 2 years later. He and his brother George were ordained on the same day in 1951. George became a parish priest. Joseph chose a quite different kind of ministry. First a doctorate, appointments at prestigious universities, and then the Vatican. A cardinal by his early 50s, an ailing Pope John Paul II made him head of the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, formerly the Roman Inquisition. There, he upheld traditional Catholic teaching on abortion, contraception, and homosexuality. He even spoke against rock music and the Harry Potter books. When John Paul died in April 2005, he was one of the Church's longest-serving cardinals and presided at the funeral. His homily, based on Jesus' instruction, "Follow me," proved prophetic. After just 4 ballots, white smoke from the Sistine Chapel announced Cardinal Ratzinger's election.
Sancte Romanae Ecclesiae, Cardinale Ratzinger.
The oldest pope for 275 years. As Pope Benedict XVI, He sought to re-evangelize the West. It was an attempt to roll back the advance of secularism in Europe and North America. But in it lay an acknowledgement of the Church's declining influence in its traditional heartlands. He also sparked controversy in 2006 when, during a lecture he gave in Germany, he quoted criticism of Islam by a 14th century Christian leader and appeared to link the religion with jihad and holy war. There were violent protests in several Muslim countries. The Pope apologized and made a point of setting up the first Catholic Muslim forum. He seemed chastened by the experience, and on visits like one to Britain, Benedict exuded pastoral warmth and warned against marginalization of religion.
I cannot but voice my concern at the increasing marginalization of religion, particularly of Christianity, that is taking place in some quarters, even in nations which place a great emphasis on tolerance.
But back in Rome, the Church was beginning to confront the scandal of sexual abuse by priests around the world. He was forced to deny that he'd played any role in covering up abuse, but the cases continued to mount.
No words of mine could describe the pain and harm inflicted by such abuse, nor can I adequately describe the damage that has occurred within the community of the Church.
He later acknowledged he'd made mistakes in handling the matter.
Now let's get more on this shock news that Pope Benedict XVI is resigning.
In February 2013, he shocked the world, announcing he would resign at the end of the month, citing age and failing health. The election of his successor, Pope Francis, represented a break with much of what Benedict had stood for. The challenge was to find a leader who could close the widening gap between a doctrinally conservative Vatican and the Church worldwide. Benedict bequeathed to his successor the challenges that so fatigued him: the scandal of child sexual abuse and diminishing congregations in the West. Pope Benedict upheld the creeds of the Church and taught them with conviction. He died as he lived, thinking and writing about how to defend and advance those creeds in an increasingly secular world.
Our religion editor, Ali McBall. Well, let's look more at the global reaction to Pope Benedict's death. In his tribute, President Biden called the former pontiff a renowned theologian, and many others have highlighted his theological skills. They include Spain's Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, who said Benedict was dedicated to the service of peace, justice, and other people. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Benedict's solidarity with marginalized people and his wish to close the gap between rich and poor were more relevant than ever. Meanwhile, Britain's King Charles praised his commitment to strengthening the relationship between the Catholic and Protestant communities. But in the German city of Munich, these residents had a mixed view of Pope Benedict's tenure.
I thought when he came to power, he would finally bring some fresh air into the Catholic Church and bring an end to celibacy. But unfortunately, he disappointed me.
I have positive memories of him. I can still remember the time when he was in the office. He represented the Church, the Catholic Church, and did what was expected of him.
The views there of residents of the German city of Munich, and this was the reaction from worshippers at the Holy Family Catholic Basilica, located in Nairobi, Kenya.
God bless his soul in peace. He has been a very good pope. He has been talking about the poor.
It's a sad day to lose the pope, but we will always remember his impact on the world and on the Catholic faith, and the Lord rests his soul in eternal peace.
Well, Benedict's death ends an extraordinary period for the Vatican when two popes were living within its walls. So then, what for the future of the Catholic Church and the structure and authority of the papacy? Rezia Iqbal spoke to the papal historian Dr. Christopher Bellito from Keene University in the United States and began by asking him about the resignation of Pope Benedict, the first pontiff to do so in 600 years.
This very tradition-bound man, a man really of the past, did something not quite unprecedented, but something that hadn't happened in 600 years in the history of the church, and that is he resigned the papacy. And for such a tradition-bound man to do so, if we can go back to 2003, 4, 5, John Paul II, whose body was really ravaged by Parkinson's, Cardinal Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict XVI, was watching that. And I think he said to himself, I'm not going to let that happen to me. But more importantly, I'm not going to let that happen to the church. So after 8 years as Pope in February of 2013, although he had made the decision apparently a few months earlier than that, he announced that he would step down. And then and now I take him at his word that he had decided the time was right. His time was up. And what struck me was that my immediate thought was humility is still a virtue. I mean, the papacy is the world's longest monarchy. And in a world that worships power and authority, who steps away? He stepped away.
The person who took over, Pope Francis, was a kind of popular successor, if you like. And Benedict was seen very much as this kind of serious intellectual figure. Do you think that the contrast between the two did provoke fears of a schism, not least because for the first time in many centuries, two popes were living inside the Vatican?
Yes, well, let's clarify that there were not two popes. There was a former pope and a current pope. The problem was that the post-papacy was run rather poorly. And so it is very easy to think that there are two popes, such as you just said, because the former pope is still wearing white. The former pope is still going by his papal name, and he is still giving interviews and publishing. And so one of the lessons of the post-papacy of Benedict XVI is that in a future post-papacy, we need to do this better. And theologically, there's more continuity between Benedict and Francis than most people would like to say. It's a difference in emphasis. Benedict was very much looking within the church, Francis very much looking outside the church. In a sense, Francis has much in common with John Paul II as well. I felt badly for whoever was elected after John Paul II. I mean, do you really want to be the guy who follows the guy? And now history will squish him in between John Paul II and Francis.
The voice and views there of the papal historian Dr. Christopher Bellito. Now to other news. In Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky has said the world won't forgive Russia for the terror of missile strikes on his country after another wave of attacks on Saturday, New Year's Eve. In a video address, Mr. Zelensky told Russians in their language that the war their country was waging was not with NATO, as Moscow maintained, but to keep one person, Vladimir Putin, in power. Our correspondent in Kiev, Hugo Bachega, filed this report on the last day of 2022.
On New Year's Eve, another wave of Russian missiles. The air raid alert sounded at lunchtime, on a day families usually celebrate together. The head of the Ukrainian armed forces said air defenses had shot down 12 of 20 cruise missiles. In Kyiv, debris fell on a residential area, killing one woman. Police say she was a mother of two who was in the kitchen preparing dinner. Alyona was nearby when the attack happened. Me and my husband were thrown into the corridor, she says. We heard glass shattering, and then there was one explosion after another. It was Russia's second massive airstrike on Ukraine in 3 days. President Zelensky accused Moscow of deliberately targeting civilians. He said those who had ordered the attack would not be forgiven.
At Easter, they carried out such attacks, at Christmas and at New Year. They call themselves Christians. They are very proud of their orthodoxy, but they are following the devil.
In Russia, President Putin delivered his traditional New Year's address, recorded in front of soldiers in uniform. He again said the West wanted to destroy his country and that troops were fighting to achieve peace and security guarantees for Russia. But on the last day of the year, his forces brought even more destruction to a country that's already seen so much of it.
Hugo Bachega reporting from Ukraine. Still to come.
I was just coming back from a trip, and then I saw a co-worker of mine. He's one of those, you know, tough, strong guys, and he was in tears.
The director of the National Museum in Rio de Janeiro remembers a devastating fire which engulfed the building 4 years ago. But now the institution is rising from the ashes. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has described a vote by the UN General Assembly to seek a legal opinion on Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories as, in his word, despicable. Earlier, the Palestinian authorities welcomed the move by UN members to seek a ruling from the International Court of Justice. 87 countries backed Friday's resolution, including Russia, China and Muslim nations. The US, Britain and Germany were among those voting against. In a video address, Mr. Netanyahu condemned the resolution.
Like all the hundreds of distorted decisions against Israel that were passed by the UN General Assembly over years, the despicable decision that was passed today will not bind the Israeli government. The Jewish people are not occupiers on their own land, nor occupiers in our eternal capital, Jerusalem, and no UN resolution can warp that historical truth.
The ICJ is the UN's top court dealing with disputes between states. Its rulings are binding, although it has no powers of enforcement. The main opposition party in the self-declared Republic of Somaliland says 10 people have been killed and 50 injured during days of clashes between security forces and protesters. The unrest in the town of Lasanar began on Tuesday after gunmen killed a politician. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
Security forces in the town of Lasanar are being accused of using excessive force against the protesters. Hospitals have been appealing for blood to help those seriously injured with gunshot wounds after several days of unrest. The self-declared Republic of Somaliland has been far more peaceful than most of Somalia. But that stability is under threat. Clan rivalries are growing, and there's anger that President Muse Bihi Abdi's term was extended until 2024. There are fears that further insecurity could enable al-Shabaab Islamist militants to move into Somaliland.
Will Ross. As the world tries to decide how to respond to China ending its restrictive COVID policies amid a surge of cases in the country, President Xi Jinping has directly addressed the issue in his New Year's speech to the nation. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, has this report.
Xi Jinping's New Year's speeches don't have a reputation of being that interesting. In fact, there's usually more interest in looking at the photographs arranged behind him in his office. But this year, with China going through a major COVID crisis, Xi Jinping couldn't avoid using the C word. He said there were difficult times ahead.
The control and prevention of the epidemic is now entering a new phase, but it's still a time of struggle. Let's work harder. Persistence means victory, and unity means victory.
These are his first comments about COVID since China relaxed its pandemic rules. Mr. Xi said that had been done because of an evolving situation, although he didn't say what that was. Part of it must have been, though, the street protests which took place at the end of November. Just a few weeks later, China abandoned its zero COVID policy. And Mr. Xi made reference to the differences of opinion that can sometimes exist within China.
China is so big a country. Different people will have different demands and different views on the same thing, which is normal. It is necessary to build consensus through communication and consultation.
Of course, what he didn't say is that the Communist Party, which has ruled for more than 70 years, doesn't usually allow those differences of opinion to be expressed in public. And Mr. Xi will certainly not want to encourage anyone to express their own views on other issues in the future.
Michael Bristow. As news emerged from the Vatican of the death of Pope Benedict, over in the US, tributes were also being paid to the television journalist Barbara Walters, who's died aged 93. Barbara Walters was said to be a smasher of so-called glass ceilings, the first female to host the important Today Show and the first female presenter of a network evening programme. In a 50-year career, she interviewed anyone who was anyone. Among her many career highlights, she bagged an exclusive interview in 1999 with the former White House intern Monica Lewinsky, who'd had an affair with President Bill Clinton. And it got the biggest audience, 70 million, for a news programme on a single network.
Monica?
Are you still in love with Bill Clinton?
No.
Sure?
Mm-hmm.
Over?
Sometimes I have warm feelings, sometimes I'm proud of him still, and sometimes I hate his guts, and he makes me sick.
What will you tell your children when you have them?
Mommy made a big mistake.
And that is the understatement of the year.
Well, who better to turn to talk about Barbara Walters than a current doyen of television news, Christiane Amanpour of CNN. The BBC's Raza Iqbal first asked her about what Barbara Walters meant to her growing up and watching US television.
Well, Razia, interestingly, I grew up in Iran and in the UK, and Barbara Walters' legend and her work even reached these parts of the world, because although she was the most prominent female American journalist on television, she was pretty much the most prominent female journalist in the world. And so we saw many of her recordings and her interviews and her specials. And so as a young girl growing up, before I even knew I wanted to be a journalist, she most definitely was an inspiration for me.
So an inspiration, which of course she was for many, but then the two of you became friends.
I mean, look, Barbara Walters was, you know, way, way above me on the pyramid of achievement and success. And we, you know, there was a considerable age difference. But I do believe that when we finally met, she saw in me somebody who wanted to be a really, you know, big journalist like her, but also was willing to put in the work like she did, and also was a woman, obviously. And, you know, Barbara Walters was the first and only in so many, many occasions and in so many fields that she had to plow for the rest of us a very, very lonely road. But really, her body of work, her massive, incomparable body of work, which spanned every aspect of our public space in terms of entertainment or politics and all the rest of it, will not be replicated. I'm absolutely convinced. I believe that her legend will be forever enshrined on the Mount Rushmore of our profession. The other thing I want to say is that Barbara Walters carried on through being elderly on television. She gave us all the space to also be, you know, older women on television. She was quick, she was sharp until the day she retired in her 80s.
Clearly a pioneer in so many ways. And when she was appointed as the first high-profile female journalist on a primetime show, her co-anchor privately dismissed her hire as a gimmick. Do you think it was her character that propelled her forward and that she managed to stay in the business for 50 years, pretty much at the top of her game?
Well, I think it was her character, but believe me, it was always also her competence. And that is the most important thing to remember. The people who said those sour things about a gimmick or about, you know, just a diversity hire or whatever, honestly, it's just jealousy. And it's just because people of that generation didn't know how to deal with an emerging new reality. And that was that women were stepping into this business and were represented by this pioneer. She earned every single stripe that came her way. It's not an accident that every single American president since, you know, in those at least 40 years back, at least back to Reagan, you know, she interviewed. It's not an accident that she won the interviews with all the major Hollywood stars, all the major political heavyweights.
Let's talk about her style of interviewing. She had this kind of genteel insistence, which often surprised people. These days, we set so much store by the aggressive style of interviewer, trying to trip people up to get a news line.
She had a very important, persistent style. You couldn't hide behind it. You couldn't get away from it. She was going to keep asking the questions until she got the answer that she wanted. However, she was not a gotcha journalist. She didn't go in to just try to score a cheap hit. And I think that's what made her stand out, and that's what made her interview so revealing.
The unmistakable voice there of Christiane Amanpour. 4 years ago, a devastating fire engulfed the National Museum in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil's oldest scientific institution, and almost the entire collection of around 20 million items was destroyed. Repairs of the main building, which used to be a royal palace, are in full swing, and work to restore the facade has been completed. The BBC's Nick Miles went to meet the museum's director, Alexander Kellner, and began by asking him about the night of the fire.
I was just coming back from a trip. When my son talked to me, I mean, he said there was a problem. And I was imagining maybe his mother or his brother. Then he said, no, fire. And then I said, fire? My apartment? My God? They said, no, it's the museum. And I said, no, that's not possible. And then I saw a co-worker of mine. He's one of those, you know, tough, strong guys. And he was in tears.
And you were here throughout the night watching these flames, which were leaping the same height again as the building itself. What was your feelings at the time?
First of all, of great anger, because I couldn't do anything. I could just be watching. And when I arrived, I managed to go inside the building with the firefighters, and I saw it was not much could be done. But there were some parts where we still could rescue materials. So I ordered that. We rescued a few things.
Now, the one area that you can actually see inside and see the power that the fire obviously brought on this building is right at the front and the bottom. There's a small exhibition of minerals, and it was the minerals and the meteorites and things that were so resistant to the fire that survived, isn't it?
To be very honest with you, the only specimen actually that really resisted is the Bendengo, which is the largest meteorite from Brazil with over 5 tons.
And we're just seeing one room here behind these grey, plasticky sheets. A lot of work is going on. We can hear it in the distance, in fact, that workmen are perhaps reconstructing. What's going on? And is this representative of everything else in the building?
That noise that you hear is for us music, because it shows that we are moving forward. Our plans are to finish completely the museum if we get the appropriate funding and the necessary collections in 2027. Okay, here we are.
Well, we've been left by the director in a small, I suppose it's a bit like a porter cabin. And inside, what we've got, we're confronted with extraordinarily rusted containers, metal containers, and inside, if I can just peek over the top, I can see some exhibits. Luciana Carvalho is a curator here. Luciana, what are we seeing in these boxes?
Nós estamos vendo materiais da coleção de
So Luciana is saying there that what we're seeing here are some of the items from the museum that were taken during the fire and after the fire that could be preserved. So what we're seeing here is a fossil. It looks like the hand or the hand bones of a dinosaur. And Luciana is saying that they're particularly important, that unique here to Brazil. So back at the museum itself now with the director. And I suppose the final question is really, in these times of political upheaval in Brazil with lots of polarization, how important is a museum, the role of a museum in bringing people together?
The museum has no parties. It's not a political institute. We are here for the people, nationally, internationally. And our goal is to make people think about the world around us and at the same time to make everyone dream. I think the best way is to make an open space and to show natural sciences for people, the different cultures that we have in our country, where we show what's happening and they can react towards that.
Alexander Kellner ending that report from Nick Miles in Rio de Janeiro. Now, here's some inspiration for you for 2023. A man from Cumbria in northern England who set out to complete a marathon every day in 2022 has finished his 365th run. Gary McKee, whose father died of cancer, hoped to raise over $1.2 million for two cancer charities, and he's reached that target. The 53-year-old crossed the finishing line with his family on Saturday afternoon, and Howard Johnson's been following his journey.
Three, two, one, go!
He's run more than 9,500 miles, has gone through more than 20 pairs of trainers, and often finished his daily 26.2-mile route before starting work.
I'm running 365 marathons in 365 days.
Meet Cumbrian marathon man Gary McKee, who spoke to the BBC before he set off for his 365th run.
I'm a little bit nervous. You know, it is the last one.
But it went without a hitch, with Gary running the distance in just over 4 hours.
The streets were lined. You know, it was raining, but everybody was still out and everybody's clapping and shouting. All the cars had stopped. It was something I'll always remember.
The father of three will give all of the money he's raised to Macmillan Cancer Support and a hospice in West Cumbria. They've described his achievement as off the scale and say he's sprinkled magic on the community.
That report by Howard Johnson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast a little later. If you want to comment on this one or any of the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Stuart Willey. The producer was Liam McSheffrey and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Gareth Barlow. Until next time, goodbye. And wherever you are, we wish you all a very happy new year.
The BBC World Service has a world of podcasts just waiting to be discovered. Hi, I'm Namulanta, and season one of my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is available in full now. It's a handbook to life written for daughters everywhere.
My darling daughter, you're so much more than the color of your skin, the features of your face and body, the social class you come from, and who you marry. Those do not define you.
For Tales of the Unexpected, the Lives Less Ordinary podcast lays bare remarkable personal stories from around the world.
I had this secret.
And I just felt the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
I started having a strength in me.
Or to explore the stories behind the medals, the On the Podium podcast has some of the world's top athletes sharing their journeys to success.
How can I use this pain and this energy?
I think that breaking down stereotypes is so important.
That is a significant moment when you first win a medal at Olympic Games.
Whatever you're looking for in a podcast, the BBC World Service has something for you.
And it all gels together beautifully.
We're ready to go. We're ready to have fun. We're ready to party.
You can catch up with Dear Daughter, Lives Less Ordinary, and On the Podium now by searching for them wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Challenge yourself as a leader and transform your career with a top-ranked MBA from Berkeley Haas. Gain access to a world-class university located in the epicenter of innovation and engage with renowned faculty, mentors, and collaborative peers. The evening and weekend MBA program delivers a robust MBA experience on your schedule. Excel in your current role while building leadership skills for what comes next. Visit haas.org/apply to start your Berkeley Haas application today.